Moncrief on News Talk.
Groups of people, often large people, can adhere to all sorts of crazy ideas despite the constraints of common sense, contradictions, or evidence to the contrary. William Bernstein is the author of The Delusion of Crowds, Why People Go Mad in Groups. And he joins us now on News Talk. Good afternoon, William.
Good afternoon, sir.
If mass delusions have always been with us, are there examples of damaging ones but also examples of benign ones?
Well, in the first place, we're human beings, so we are subject to mass delusions, the mass delusions that are all around us. So the good mass delusions are the ones that say that the little pieces of paper we carry in our pocket are useful as money, or that we all believe in democracy and the sanctity of elections and the rule of law and the independence of our judiciary. Those are the good delusions. And the problem, of course, is that when people stop believing in them, they stop being true. It's the Tinkerbell phenomenon. Mm. And then, of course, there are mass delusions, as we've seen, particularly in my own home country, of mass delusions that are quite harmful.
Right. Okay. For QAnon being a prime example of that. Does it get more complicated in the sense of how can we tell what is a benign mass delusion and what's a negative one? In that QAnon adherents seem to think that everyone else was deluded and they knew the truth.
Well, the problem is you have to be epistemically grounded. You have to know what is the truth and what is not the truth. So, for example, probably the biggest mass delusion right now in the United States is that the election was stolen from Donald Trump. Mm. And I think that as adjudicated by more than 60 courts, as well as, you know, members of Trump's own administration, that is frankly not true. If you want to, you know, delve into the facts yourself, you'll find out that it's not true. On the other hand, if you are firmly in the other camp, there's no shortage of theories that will support your point of view. So that's the problem. The problem is to be epistemically grounded, to actually know what the truth is.
Yeah, I suppose in probably in the majority of cases, people who would believe that Joe Biden won the election would just believe it without necessarily doing a huge amount of research, because it seems to them to be a common sense thing. Does that imply that we're perhaps never, no matter what we're believing or not believing, that we're not as rational as we like to think we are?
Well, of course we're not. We're human beings, and human beings are first and foremost not terribly rational. We prefer narratives over facts. And that, of course, is part of the epistemic problem. It's knowing the difference between narrative and fact. And it calls up, you know, sort of a real dichotomy, which is that if you're someone who is trying to sell opinions, you want to use narratives because they're much more effective than facts are. But on the other hand, if you're a consumer of opinions, you want to ignore narratives and you simply want to focus on the facts. And the facts are, for example, when it comes to the election being stolen, that no attorney walked into court and actually alleged fraud, because had they done so, they would have been lying, and you can't do that.
But narratives seem to sell better than facts, be that in any area, not just politics, religion, business, all those kinds of things.
Yeah, my favorite example of that occurred in late 2015 during one of the early Republican Party primaries. And one of the candidates, a man by the name of Ben Carson, who was a neurosurgeon, as it turns out, was asked about the efficacy and the safety of vaccines. And he gave the conventional medical answer, which was that they were perfectly safe, and that he was going to vaccinate his kids and his grandkids. And he was, which is the correct answer, and he was interrupted by candidate Trump, who said that he had an employee who had a daughter who was a beautiful child who developed autism after an inoculation, which was probably not true. And that, you know, she, there was an epidemic. It was an epidemic, I tell you, of autism in this country. Now, most people who saw that interchange scored it for Trump, despite the fact that he was dead wrong on every count.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, this idea of kind of selling these kinds of stories, does it trigger something in our brains, in our Stone Age brains, if you like, that we see the rest of our tribe doing something, so we think that must be the thing to do?
Well, yeah, there are two different strains here. Number one is, first and foremost, and this is one of the main points of my book, we are the ape that imitates. And the paradigm that is the most useful for understanding this is to imagine how human beings spread from the Bering Strait at the end of the last ice age down all the way through North and South America over a period of not much more than several thousand years. And so we had to learn how to build kayaks, and hunt bison on the Great Plains, and to construct poison blow darts, blow guns in the Amazon. And those are all things that are almost impossible to do unless you've seen it done before, and then you can imitate it. And so we very rapidly, Mother Nature very rapidly selected for our ability to imitate. And that's fine in a Stone Age world, but it can become profoundly dysfunctional in the modern post-industrial society, most particularly in the financial markets.
Also, you do deal to a certain extent with religious extremism in the books. We're very aware of examples of that in the age we live in now. You trace a lot of it back to Dublin, to Trinity College. What happened there?
Well, there were two Protestant theologians by the name of Richard Graves and John Nelson Darby, and they developed an interpretation of eschatology, the study of how the world ends, that involves the books of the Bible. And it was this very complex, arcane, and quite frankly, not terribly interesting system. But what happened over the next 200 years is that Protestant theologians and ministers and then popular authors evolved this into an extremely compelling narrative involving the return of the Jews to Israel, the building of a third temple, a military holocaust involving, you know, tens and hundreds of millions of Russians and Chinese, a confederation between Israel and the 10 nations of a reformed European Roman empire, and finally, you know, Jesus returning and just about everybody except non-believers being cast into a lake of fire, with believers being raptured to heaven before all of this goes down. It's a very bizarre narrative. And the funny thing is that, you know, if you explain that narrative to most secular people in the world, and particularly secular Americans, their jaws just drop. But what they don't realize is that it's a narrative that's as familiar as, you know, Gone with the Wind or The Godfather to about 30% of the population who devoutly believe it and believe that they're going to be raptured and saved and that this event is going to occur during their lifetime.
So is it pretty much the same mental mechanism that occurs in financial markets? And is there possibly an example of that happening right now?
Well, yeah, there's two different, you're asking two different questions. The mechanism is basically the same, which is that, you know, we are the ape that imitates, and we like narratives, particularly compelling narratives. What more compelling narrative than that the world is going to, you know, end in a fiery death, but you're going to be saved because you believe? That's very both compelling and pleasing to you. And it's also very pleasing to believe that you're going to become effortlessly rich by investing in, you know, this stock or that cryptocurrency. So it appeals to us in a number of different levels. Are we in the middle of some bubbles right now? And the answer to that is almost certainly yes. What we see now are what you see typically historically during financial bubbles, this whole sequence of events and observations that we see playing out right in front of us.
Yeah, because certainly for Bitcoin and the like, you get the sense that people who support it are evangelical about it and become kind of angry at non-believers.
Well, yes, those are the main features of a bubble. There's four of them that I identified. Number one is when any sort of financial speculation becomes topic A in social situations. So, you know, you walk into a taxi and the taxi driver or the Uber driver starts talking to you about Bitcoin, or you can't go to a party without hearing about a neighbor who's gotten fabulously rich investing in Bitcoin. That's a bubble. When you see people otherwise quitting good paying jobs to day trade, that's a bubble. When you see people not just disagreeing with you, but actually getting violently angry at you when you express skepticism, that's a bubble. And then finally, when you see extreme predictions, you know, Bitcoin is not going to increase by 5 or 10% over the next year. It's going to add a zero or two. That's a bubble.
Very enjoyable to speak to you today. That was William Bernstein there. The name of his book is The Delusion of Crowds, Why People Go Mad in Groups. William, thank you very much.
My pleasure, sir.
Moncrief on News Talk.